Thank you so much. Thank you, Rabbi Yossi Friedman and the Meruber community for organizing again the series. And I look forward, hopefully soon, to visiting the shul in the physical sense and sharing some ideas with you. But in the meantime, this is a great way to connect. So this is how we're doing things. So I thought what we'd do is just for a very few minutes, just to review quickly what we covered last week. We talked about mental health awareness being so important. Important to talk about it, important to raise consciousness and awareness. Even a more critical discussion, as Rabbi Friedman mentioned, about during this period, where there's heightened stress and heightened anxiety and heightened mental weakness and so on and so forth. And part of that awareness is removing the stigma, which we think is improving, but still needs discussion. So last week we discussed the Jewish view on medical intervention. We talked about the concept of a rapoy rapé, that generally in health, Torah mandates that we protect ourselves, we protect our health, which includes going to medical professionals, going to qualified and licensed medical professionals who can help us support our physical health, physiological health, and improve our health. And mental illness, as we explained, needs to be looked at the same way. It's a sickness like all other sicknesses. It needs to be seen that way. It needs to be seen not like the person could do something about it themselves, and therefore we can, not only we can, but we should seek that intervention. As we'll see even more tonight than we did last week, of course, spirituality, the rabbi, Jewish sources and so on play a very important role, but it doesn't replace, and I think this is the key thing. While it plays a role, and we'll explore that role a bit more tonight, it doesn't replace the professional intervention and the medical intervention, which is really important, whether it's a licensed, qualified doctor, psychiatrist, or a therapist, or both, or whatever the particular appropriate intervention is. It's really, really important. And just to put it into context, we discussed last week, and I think it's a very important thing to understand, that the difference between normal personal growth issues and mental illness. In other words, we all have our personality weaknesses for which we were put into this world to work on and to improve. Jewish sources, ethics, moral sources, Musar, Hasidut, Kabbalah, all deal with these issues, and that's fine. If it's a normal personality weakness, some of us are in bad moods, some of us have jealousy issues, some of us overindulge a bit, some of us are jealous, and so on and so forth. So yes, the rabbi, the mentor, the friend, the sources are good for that. But when it crosses over to a line where it becomes something that's out of the person's control, that's a whole different story. Ethics doesn't help for that. It might support it, as we all will see, but it really needs to be seen there as a something which is like a heart attack or like diabetes or like anything else, which is out of the control of the human being. It's where free choice ends, and we have something that is part of us which we cannot really control, which then we need to seek the medical intervention. And then we explored quite at length last week also some of the early sources, the Jewish sources, where amazingly some of those sources actually discuss and highlight and acknowledge the condition of mental illness. We talked about the story of Shaul HaMelech being overcome with what seems to be depression, described very much as it is today, the melancholy, the psychosis that the Talmud discusses, and so on and so forth, and many others. And we concluded again the importance of raising awareness, the importance of reaching out to other people, particularly during this time. And one of the greatest things we can do is just to reach out to people, to ask them if they're okay, and sometimes to encourage them to seek the right help. Because the one difference, and I'll just finish the review with this before we get into tonight's discussion, the one difference between seeking help when we have physiological or physical illness to when we have mental illness is that physical illness, we can make the choice and we need to make the choice, and we have that moral and intellectual capacity to seek the intervention that we need, whereas someone who's suffering with mental illness often is mentally stressed and therefore needs to seek the intervention but not always able to, and therefore it becomes a collective responsibility to support each other and to encourage each other, and especially during this time, just to reach out and see if people are okay and to encourage them to take the right path. Okay, so tonight what I want to do is, and part of the raising awareness, part of the importance of raising awareness, is look at some of the common conditions, things like depression, OCD, anxiety, addiction, and so forth. Talk about the partnership between the spiritual, religious, Torah-type guidance and professional treatment. I'm going to look at some very interesting correspondence from the Lubavitcher Rebbe on this topic, because he wrote extensively to different people on these concepts. Have a look at some of the halachic responses in certain mental illness scenarios. And not necessarily in this order, but these are the type of things we're going to try and cover this week, this session. Okay, so once again, I'm going to look at depression and obsessiveness and OCD and so forth. I want to, again, make it very clear that I'm not a licensed professional. When people come to me with these issues, I always refer them on. I remain as a support, but I always try to make sure that they're seeking the right intervention. There are many different approaches to some of the things I'm going to be sharing with you. I didn't make these things up myself. It's from my research, from my reading, from reliable sources, from people that I've spoken to who are professionals. And I share it to raise the awareness. I apologize if there's anyone who's a professional in the audience that might catch me out on not being completely 100% accurate, or maybe takes a different approach. That's not so much the issue. The issue is more the raising awareness of it. So I share with you the best I can. And again, emphasize that when these things happen, we need to seek the proper medical intervention. So one of the things that is fairly common is depression. Depression is actually on the rise, unfortunately. It's across cultures. Some of the research is actually not quite sure why it's happening. Although there certainly are factors that seem to be common in modern society that certainly contribute or perhaps trigger sometimes the condition of depression. According to some studies, it's more prevalent in the Jewish community. I'm not sure why. But nevertheless, it is something that is very prevalent. It's something that we need to be a little bit aware of. It's something we need to raise awareness about, both for ourselves, because sometimes we can go through periods of depression and we need to know what that is and what it looks like, or at least know what it could look like so we can seek help. Certainly if we see it with other people. Now, I want to give a little bit of introduction, again, particularly from a Jewish perspective. Important to clarify. Depression is not being very sad. That's not depression, right? Because what I like to always do when I talk about this, and I sort of got this from Dr. Pelkovitz, is to differentiate between what we talk about, depression with a small d, and depression with a big D. Depression with a small d is what we call in the classic Jewish literature, atzvut, being sad, not being joyful, not being besimcha, right? Now, we know that in Torah, there's an incredible emphasis on happiness, an incredible emphasis on serving God with joy. As the verse tells us, ivdu et Hashem besimcha, serve God constantly with a feeling of joy, with a feeling of happiness, with a feeling of inner fulfillment, right? And if you look in Jewish sources, Kabbalistic sources, Hasidic sources, ethic sources, philosophical sources, you will see they are filled with topics and essays and discussions on the concept of simcha and joy, and eitzot, advice, and formulae, and all kinds of strategies to how to achieve joy. Now that's all true when we talk about people who are unhappy with what they are, unhappy with what they have. Mindset changing can do a lot to change that. When you get proper perspective, when you get the proper mindset, when you have better faith in God, when you have more purpose and meaning, all these things are so important and can certainly help a person that is unhappy to become happier, to eradicate or to remove the depression with a small d. But when we talk about the clinical depression, we're talking about depression with a big D, is completely different. Number one, first of all, it doesn't always look the same. It comes with different levels of severity. But whatever it comes with, when you talk about depression with a big D, it's more serious than just sadness, and it's qualitatively different. Now, the literature that's there in Jewish sources that help a person increase happiness is still relevant even when we talk about depression with a big D. Because that's what we're going to see. You see, the it's a very complex condition, and therefore the concepts that encourage happiness, the concepts that inspire happiness, will be very beneficial even when we talk about people suffering with clinical depression. But it's still very different. And when a person suffers from depression with a big D, those sources are not the first point of call, number one. And those sources and those strategies and the spiritual guidance is there as a support, but doesn't replace the critical medical intervention that is needed. Because when it clinical depression really means that a person has reached a point where some of that unhappiness or some of that dysfunction is now out of the person's control, and therefore needs to seek the right guidance. So the spiritual guidance and the spiritual sources and the classic sources, the Torah sources, certainly serve as a support, and by the way, certainly contribute to prevention, as we'll soon see. But if a person is experiencing depression, once again, it's a sickness, it's a condition, we need to seek help. Because depression with a big D, we know, involves all sorts of symptoms. It can involve physiological changes in the body, the way a person feels physically. It involves our moods, it involves the thinking process, thoughts that come into our mind that are very difficult, almost impossible sometimes to get rid of. They say that a depressive disorder is an illness that involves the body, the mood, the thoughts, and it affects the way a person eats and sleeps and the way a person feels about themselves. Those are kind of the symptoms sometimes of depression. Now let's just have a look briefly at some of the things and then sort of talk about just the perspective. So when we talk about major depression with a big D, is manifested in a combination of symptoms. And essentially what those symptoms do often is they interfere with a person's ability to work, to study, to sleep, to eat, and enjoy the normal pleasures of life, right? Now, this can occur once, it can occur for a short time, or it can be for a long time. There are different types. There are sometimes less severe types of depression where a person is not disabled, but nevertheless, it still affects the functioning, still affects the inner feeling of calmness. They can have different episodes, they can come and go in different levels of severity and so on and so forth. So some symptoms of depression that are important to be aware of, and again, I'm saying this not so much from a Jewish perspective, but just to create some sort of awareness is really important. Depression often comes with things like persistent, sad and anxious emptiness, a feeling of complete emptiness. Anxiety often, feelings of hopelessness, pessimism all the time, constant pessimism. Often it comes with real feelings of guilt, like deep guilt. Now, not to say that, I mean, you know, we all have guilt because we're Jewish, but and that's kind of comes with a package. But I'm talking about deep guilt when a person walks around constantly with guilt, or real severe worthlessness or helplessness. Loss of interest. When you see a person, you know, is always bubbly and they like to play golf, or they like to eat certain foods, or they like to do certain activities, and suddenly they just lose interest in all these pleasurable activities. Now, I'm not advocating an overindulgence in pleasurable activities, but when a person likes certain things and we enjoy certain parts of life and suddenly we lose energy and we lose interest in those, that's one of the symptoms. Decreased energy, fatigue, just feeling slowed down, difficulty concentrating, remembering, difficulty making decisions, the inability to sleep, insomnia, early morning waking, or sometimes oversleeping, not be able to get out of bed, appetite, weight loss, or overeating, weight gain. And of course, thoughts of death or thoughts of suicide, restlessness, irritability, these are all symptoms or of depression. Now, it doesn't mean, by the way, you have to get all these symptoms to be depressed. It's some of these symptoms also, but these are just some of the list that we need to be aware of. Now, what is the cause of depression, right? And I think this is an important awareness also because it connects to what I want to share with you in terms of the Jewish perspective and the combination between the partnership, I should say, between the spiritual guidance and proper professional or medical intervention. So the cause of depression actually is very complicated. First of all, it's not the same with everyone, right? And it's a combination. It's a very, very complex interrelationship between the emotional, the physiological, the genetic, and the hormonal, right? And each one is sometimes a major cause, or sometimes they come together, or sometimes it's one or the other, one excluding the other. Very, very often, and we know this today to be much more, and we talked about this last week, and this is why severe depression is such an important thing to create an awareness of it. Where so often depression becomes, no matter how it started or what triggered it, but depression becomes purely a physiological thing. It's a chemical imbalance, for which sometimes there is no other course, but together with other therapy, we sometimes need medication. And when a person needs that medication, it's important to get it, right? Now, not only medication, but a combination of things. But the reason why medication is sometimes so helpful and sometimes not easy to diagnose or not easy to prescribe necessarily, but nevertheless, it certainly does play a very important role because depression is so physiological and it has very, very, very pronounced physiological symptoms and physiological causes like chemical imbalances. This is so true, for example, when women give birth, postpartum depression is very, very often physiological, hormonal, and so on, for which therapy can help, but so can medication. But that's not to say that it's all... Now, it can happen purely physiological. I mean, there are people who have come to see me, and again, I don't treat depression, but they've come to see me because sometimes the rabbi is the first port of call. But I've had people come to see me who are clearly, you don't need to be a therapist to see that they're clearly suffering from depression. And they had no particular trigger, no trauma, no severe unhappiness, nothing wrong in their life. It's something that just sets in. It can happen in older age particularly, but it can happen any time of life where suddenly a person goes through a bout of depression. It can be hereditary. It can be purely something that is purely physiological or any other illness. And of course, they need to seek help. But what can also happen is it can be physiological, but it can be triggered by lots of emotional stuff. It can be triggered by a sense of emptiness, by a sense of hopelessness, by a sense of lack of purpose and meaning. It can be triggered by trauma. It can be triggered by conflict. It can be triggered by lots of different things. Which is why the spiritual component that I talk about is so critically important. Number one, critically important for prevention, because although depression, again, and I emphasize, I hope I'm not sounding boring, because I like to emphasize these things again and again, because people shouldn't make a mistake. Because although depression can hit anyone, no matter how healthy they are, physically or emotionally, but often it can be triggered by lack of certain health standards, lack of emotional health or lack of physical health, lack of purpose, lack of meaning. And that's why, number one, the spiritual component certainly contributes to prevention. We know that there are studies that people with structure, people with meaning, people who have goals. I saw a fascinating study once where apparently the percentages of depression in Israel, of all places, is less because it's a very focused society, very high, strong society, perhaps, but a very focused society because they're always on alert. There's always a mission. There's always a purpose, right? So giving people meaning, giving people purpose, giving people a sense of accomplishment in life, giving people what Viktor Frankl spoke about, the search for meaning, the fulfillment, the inner fulfillment of meaning, that feeling of inner contentment by living a life of meaning and purpose can certainly play a role in prevention of depression. Won't always be that way, as I said, because sometimes it's a simple sickness. As can, by the way, healthy eating, good exercising, all these things can play tremendous roles in prevention of depression. But not only in prevention, it can also play a very, very important role in the treatment of depression. Again, not as a replacement of professional therapy and or medication, but certainly as a supporting role, a very important supporting role of putting back into the individual those very things that brought about depression or might have triggered the depression, like a sense of structure, a sense of meaning, and a sense of purpose. Often depression comes from loss, by the way. I've read it already about it, that we know that mental health issues are certainly on the rise in the current situation. We learned today that the numbers came out of unemployment. There are 600,000 people in Australia lost their jobs last month, right? One of them are quite a high percentage of young people. That will be, not in everyone, but it will be in some person, a trigger for anxiety or depression. Often it has to do with trauma as a child, the sense of learned helplessness or very, very damaged and low self-esteem. All of these things can certainly play a role. Now, as I said before, that's why depression is a complicator. You see, mental illness is, as I say, it's an illness. It needs to be treated as such. It needs to be treated just like a physiological illness. But because the reason that it's so complicated sometimes is because it is very complex, because it's an interplay between emotions, between physiological symptoms, between causes. It's very, very multifaceted, which is why the treatment of depression also needs to be very, very multifaceted, right? And I find that more awareness, as we create more awareness of depression as we go along, And as the years have progressed and more education has taken place, there's been much more consensus among all types of professionals, both the psychiatrists on the one hand and therapists on the other hand, and communities in general, about the importance of the multifaceted approach to treating depression. What I mean by that is, first of all, on a professional level, the combination between medication and therapy is crucial, right? Because what happens is sometimes it is a chemical imbalance. Sometimes it will not be treated by therapy alone. A person has to go to a medical professional, a psychiatrist, and actually be medicated. And that can be for a short amount of time or a long amount of time, as any illness. But often what that medication does, it doesn't take away the trigger. It creates calmness. It creates space within the person. And then what that does is, the space that it creates, or the removal of some of the symptoms of depression that it creates, creates the space for the therapy to be much more effective. But there still needs to be therapy, because there's triggers of depression which have to do with the emotional makeup, with a sense of loss, with a sense of emptiness, with a sense of purposelessness, and so on and so forth, for which therapy can be very, very, negative thinking and all this kind of stuff, where therapy can be very beneficial. But often the therapy is not beneficial if the physiological imbalance hasn't been taken care of. So the partnership between those two things is really, really critical. Which is why we add into the mix, from a Jewish perspective, why it is so important that the Jewish component, the spiritual component, together with the spiritual guidance, or the role of a spiritual guide, is also so important. It becomes part of the therapy. I often have referred people to therapy, but What I've offered to do, and I think this is the role of a rabbi or a spiritual guide, is to stay the course as a support. And what will often happen is that the person will give permission to the therapist to talk to me, and we will talk, I communicate, so I get a picture, and we can provide the spiritual support at the same time. When that happens, it's actually really, really helpful and really, really effective. And the reason is because things like community are very important as a support. Things like spirituality, which bring meaning and purpose, can be so helpful for someone who's depressed. Things like offering a purpose, a sense of giving. You know that giving brings tremendous meaning to a person. So often, sometimes when we can include someone in a community and we can give them a focus, or we can give them opportunities to volunteer or to be involved in chesed, in kindness, again, not as a replacement, but as a support role, that can be really, really beneficial and a very effective support mechanism in the process of healing. But again, I want to emphasize again that if someone is at the point of depression where it becomes medically important for them to take medication, it's not just a good idea. It is a halachic obligation to do that, as it would be with any other illness. Just to unpack this a little bit more, when we talk about helping someone that might be depressed, the reason why I've shared this all with you is because I think it's important to have a little bit of an awareness of the symptoms, awareness of what it could look like, and awareness of the importance of helping people. Because as I said last week, it's important to realize that some of these things could trigger. It's important to realize what the person might look like, what some of the symptoms are, because mental illness, number one, we can all go through it. And number two, we all know someone who is going through it, because it's so prevalent. And as I said last week, with this great crowd that we have here today, I don't doubt that someone you know, or yourselves, or someone in your family, or someone that you know, will be experiencing some mental health issue. And as we said last week, it's a communal responsibility, and therefore this awareness is so important, so we can help the person. So some of the support that we can give other people, both from a practical point of view, but from a spiritual point of view, from a Jewish point of view as well, is to support the person, to encourage the person to get help, and to follow orders, to follow the therapist, to follow the psychiatrist, to get a really proper and important diagnosis. The other thing we can often do is offer emotional support. There's nothing like being there for someone, but non-judgmentally, right? Just to be in conversation, to listen to the person, not to ignore them, not to belittle their comments, never to say things, you know, I think you just need to get it together, right? You know, you might say to your child who's annoying you and just been in a bad mood because their friend said something to them at school that wasn't nice, then you could say, you know, just ignore it or get it together, or someone just who's just in a bad mood and annoying you, you know, that's fine. But when someone is really experiencing proper depression, that's the worst thing you can say to someone, because just simply they're not able to do that. That's not true, right? Certainly, if we reach out to someone and they give us, by the way, remarks or comments about things like suicide, never take that lightly. Report it to someone. You need to share that with someone's relative, or share it with a therapist, and so on and so forth. Now, what we also need to do is, and this is, you know, this I've heard from people who are very, very, very qualified in the field. Part of the support is to try and support people who are in depression to come back and re-participate in hobbies, in religious activities. It might be sport, might be other things, but not to push too hard. We need to understand that while those things, it is important for someone who is experiencing depression to get back into structure, but they're not able to do it. So therefore, pushing too hard is counterproductive and discouraging, and sometimes becomes a judgmental thing. So support in a nice way, gently encouraging people to become part, maybe not the whole thing, come for some of the time. You know, when we go back to shul, if someone, you know, don't come back to shul. If you can't come, come back 10 minutes, come back 15 minutes. Those things are helpful, but never to be pushed too hard, and certainly not to accuse the person of laziness or faking and so on and so forth. Now, just to talk a little bit about some of the therapies, and I think it's important because here again, the Jewish view sort of plays a role. There's different types of therapies. Often, one of the therapies that's also used in treating depression is something they call CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy essentially allows or teaches a person to manage their thinking, right? And part of the managing the thinking is to interpret their thinking and to reframe their thinking. So if they're having negative thinking, and part of the depression also involves judging other people or jealousness or anxious thinking and so on and so forth, we teach people therapists teach people in CBT to manage that thinking and to be able to reframe that thinking in a positive and helpful way, which again, here, it's beneficial to have that partnership between the spiritual belief, because often managing the thinking, there are lots of Jewish ideas which are very beneficial and come into the formula of managing those thinking, like things like emunah, things like faith, bitachon, you know, belief in God, belief that God runs the world, belief of things that happen by divine providence. And often those concepts and the studying of those ideas can often be very supportive in applying the skill that the person is learning in therapy of reinterpreting the thinking and reframing the thinking and so on and so forth. Part of that also, sometimes the therapy is used, I mean, different types of therapies are used. There's another therapy called ACT, which is acceptance commitment therapy, which is not so much about dealing with the thinking and reinterpreting. I know I'm being very brief here, but I just want to just highlight the concept. But it's more about accepting the thought and learning to ignore it. There's a Jewish term for that. It's called hesech hadat, which means learning to accept that I have the thought, but just ignoring it. And there are lots of Jewish concepts that support that theory. And I mean, I've actually done this with people who, under the guidance of a therapist, I've used these concepts to help a person apply those skills of learning to ignore that form of thinking. I just want to also highlight something, that part of the emptiness and part of the lack of meaning and purpose today that often triggers depression, or the low self-esteem, or the lack of accomplishment and the sort of putting oneself down and so on and so forth. There's lots of research today that anxiety has risen, anxiety and depression has increased because of technology. Now, I know that during this COVID-19 period, we have a lot to be thankful for technology. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to speak to you tonight. And technology, we know, has an amazing amount of good, but it is really, really important to understand the role of technology and to understand its potential dangers, both in the form of addiction, plus in the form of image, self-image, anxiety, and so on and so forth. And just one of the two things I want to just highlight is that, you know, one of the most important concepts in Judaism is control. Who controls what? Well, I'll give you an example. We said before, one of the symptoms of depression is very, very strong level of guilt, right? Now, I made a joke before on saying we all have guilt because we're Jewish, but the truth is that guilt actually plays a very, very important role in our personal development. Why do I say that? Because were it not for guilt, we would never grow. Meaning, if we never felt uncomfortable with anything that we'd done wrong, we would simply just never grow, right? So guilt is an important part. It's an important thing that we go through to actually feel uncomfortable where we are and feel maybe a little bit guilty about what we've done in order that we can actually fix it and move on. So what's negative guilt and positive guilt? So one of the great concepts that's discussed in the book of Tanya is this. It depends who's controlling what. In other words, if I can manage my guilt, meaning I can invite it in, I can do what's called in Judaism a cheshbon hanefesh, I can reflect, right? I can reflect and I can decide, you know, I've done something wrong. I actually feel very uncomfortable about it. I'm going to diagnose it. I'm going to reflect on it. I'm going to make a few resolutions of how I'm going to fix it in the future. And that's it. And then I say goodbye to my guilt and I move into a much more positive space. That's healthy guilt. But as soon as guilt takes me over and I cannot get rid of it, that's obsessive thinking and that's bad guilt. That's unhealthy guilt. The same thing with technology. Technology is an unbelievable tool, right? It's an unbelievable tool. And it's a tool that we believe God has created for us to do amazing things, include share wonderful Jewish ideas and reach people that we've never been able to reach before. But it only is positive when we can control the technology and the technology doesn't control us. And I'm just saying those who have younger children, those who have people that they know can have a circle of influence, we need to have a look at ourselves, we need to look at our friends and have a look at our children. Overuse of technology is very bad for mental illness. It brings addiction, it can bring anxiety, it brings all sorts of bad things, and therefore it's really, really important to limit it as a means of prevention in order to train the person not to be so connected to it. One of the things technology also brings is the lack of focus. That we're always checking our phones, we're always checking the likes on Facebook, we're always checking the Instagram, we're always checking this, always checking that, and we actually have lost the ability to focus. One of the things which are used today in treating depression, in treating negative thinking, in treating anxiety and worry, is which is very common today, is mindfulness. Now, mindfulness is the ability to be in the moment. Mindfulness is the ability to be calm, to be fully here, not to let go of the baggage of yesterday, the worries of tomorrow, and it's really the ability to focus. Now, technology doesn't help. And mindfulness is actually a good thing to engage in, both as a prevention and sometimes as a treatment, or at least a support treatment. And it's very much connected, and I've given, this is a discussion of another lecture, another series, but it certainly is connected so much with the concept in Judaism of being focused, pnimiyut, kavana, being the ability to being in the moment and using the full potential and maximizing the meaning of that particular moment. And what damages that often is technology, but also what is a good thing to do is to think about mindfulness, to learn how to live more mindfully, and that is certainly a support concept, very much supported by Jewish ideas, as a support treatment, at least for the concept of depression. So in these very few moments, I just hope I've sort of raised that awareness, number one, of what depression sort of looks like, the difference between depression with a small d and depression with a big d. If you think you're going through it, or you know someone that looks like they're going through it, encourage them to get help. And then as they get help and they get the appropriate intervention that they need to get, the role of spiritual guidance and spiritual support shouldn't be underestimated as a partnership, as a support role, and the two can go very, very well together. Something else I want to talk about, another area, which is also not so uncommon, unfortunately, is OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, unfortunately, very common, I mean, relatively common. It's an illness, like any other illness. It's really an illness. It's a debilitating illness and it's a tormenting illness. I need to tell you that people who suffer from OCD cannot help themselves. People that suffer from OCD go through terrible, terrible experiences of being tormented. What is OCD? So OCD really, in a way, divides itself into two to make it very simple. First of all, it could be obsessive thoughts and impulses and images, excessive worries about things that are really nothing to worry about. Now, I'm not talking about, again, we're Jewish, so we over-worry, we all do that, but I'm talking about real worry. I mean, I was reading about someone that sort of had this incredible anxiety about going to the dentist and put up going to the dentist for like 6 years until it was just impossible, right? And then realized after the dentist was over that it was nothing. I mean, the pain of the half an hour filling was nothing. But this incredible fear, right? So obsessive thinking, persistent thinking, it's persistent, obsessive, it's very, very hard to get rid of. That's That's one. Or the other form of obsessive compulsive, and or I should say, is repetitive behaviors. Feeling the absolute need to repeat certain behaviors. It might be hand washing, counting things, certain mental acts, checking things, checking, make sure the door's locked, and so on and so forth. Over obsessive to the point where you cannot control it, and it's completely tormenting and very, very obsessive. So those are the two ways that OCD can express itself. It causes distress. It is very time consuming. There are people that have certain obsessions that take a good chunk of the day, interferes with their normal routine. It is very, very debilitating. Sometimes the symptoms wax or wane. It can be abrupt, it can be gradual, it can get worse with time. Now, just to point out, when I talk about OCD, I'm not talking about someone who's very rigid or suffers from perfectionism, which is another disease, but not as severe, right? It's not someone who's very meticulous or rigid. That's not what OCD is. Now, number one, it's important to be aware of this, again, as consciousness of part of mental illness awareness, because it's not so uncommon, number one. Number two, it's also very important to understand in a Jewish context, because unfortunately, obsessive behaviors often manifest themselves in religious activities. Okay? Now, there is research on this. I know obviously I have a bias in this, but religion doesn't cause OCD, right? Even though Freud thought it did, but right, Freud thought that religion brings obsessiveness, but it doesn't. However, and someone who suffers from OCD will find different ways of expressing it, but often obsessive behavior actually... Sorry, someone is not unmuted. If you don't mind muting yourself, that would be great. So often it expresses itself, and I know this as a rabbi that sometimes deals with these things, that this is very true, unfortunately, and it's very, very debilitating. So it can express itself, for example, in excessive prayer, where a person thinks they haven't prayed properly, and therefore they'll repeat the words, they'll repeat paragraphs a number of times to make sure they've had the right focus. Cleanliness before prayer. In the very, very beautiful and critical mitzvah of family purity, and women going to mikveh, which needs to be done in a very, very particular way. Sometimes women with obsessive tendencies or people that suffer from OCD, often this becomes the most anxious of activities because they're over-obsessed about things that they haven't done properly, which is very bad. It can sometimes express itself in kashrut, about the over-obsessiveness about keeping separate milk and meat, and or Pesach cleaning, for example. That's a famous one. Now, I just want to give a Jewish perspective on this. In Judaism, we have a concept called Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven, which is encouraged, which means attention given to the details of mitzvot is an encouraged thing, right? To be careful, to learn the code of Jewish law, and to be particular of how we write a mezuzah, or how we put up a mezuzah, or how we put on tefillin, or what time we light Shabbat candles, or the details of any mitzvah is actually critically important. And we do encourage people to be very meticulous in their observance of mitzvot. But you know when it's gone wrong, when it's not a happy experience. Mitzvot are supposed to be things we enjoy. Yes, we're meticulous about them, as we would be meticulous in any very important task that we did in any part of life. If it's really important, we're very strict about it, we're very meticulous about it. But we still love it and we still enjoy it. When it becomes completely out of control and it becomes irrational and it becomes connected to things which are completely unnecessary and far beyond what Jewish law demands or expects, that's when it goes into the realm of being obsessive. Now, I bring this also because I'm going to get to in a moment about the involvement of religion and how we deal with this. It's a very interesting area. So the treatment of OCD, often there is medication involved. There's a lot of therapy involved in terms of managing one's thinking and so on and so forth. But in OCD, we know, and this could be very important to anyone that's listening, if you know someone or you get to know someone that has these issues, there are very important guidelines for friends, for family members, and for the rabbi. Now, I'm only raising this for an awareness. I'm not prescribing this. And if you know some of those, I suggest you speak to a professional to get exact guidance of how you should be supporting. But I want to just raise some of the issues. For example, we know that in people who suffer mental illness, it's important, right? It's important for the friend or the family. Again, important to encourage the person to seek professional help. But as a family member, they play a very important role. For example, to reassure a person, to be a supportive person, but at the same time, not to play into, because that's a big mistake family members sometimes make. There's a story I heard about someone who had this obsession that every single night they had to, there was a ritual to go through with the mother, like he would say, "I love you," and she would say, "I love you" back, and this one would say, I love your brother, "I love your sister," and it became so bad with time that it took an hour. And when the person finished school and went to college, he would call his mother every night and force her to go through this whole ritual throughout the whole hour until his roommate threatened to kill him, right? And then, figuratively speaking, and then she went for help and realized that she'd been making a mistake. She should not be giving into that. And something like calmly, like to say to the person, "I'm not going to," like sometimes a person with OCD will seek reassurance. "Do you think my hands are clear enough? Do you think I've prayed enough? Do you think I've counted this enough? Do you think I've checked enough?" You know, a simple response like, "We've agreed that I'm not going to answer this question. We've agreed I'm not going to go through the ritual with you," and sort of just to force the person to confront that fear and not to support it and not to get the person deeply and further involved in it, right? Which plays into the very interesting role that a rabbi or a spiritual mentor can actually play in the treatment of someone with OCD. You know, there's a very big difference sometimes how rabbis relate, or halachic authorities, I should say, relate to people as opposed to therapists. Right? Therapists don't order people. They suggest, they support, they encourage. Whereas sometimes a rabbi can give a definitive ruling, right? Or we call it in Hebrew, we give a psak, a halachic ruling, an absolute halachic ruling. Now, that's one very, very important role the rabbi could play. And I'll tell you an interesting story. It just goes, it's interesting how some early Jewish sources deal with this kind of stuff. There's a letter from a great sage called the Stipler Goyen. He lived, he must have passed away a good 60, 70 years ago, I think. Maybe not so much, maybe more, no, maybe like 50 years ago. And someone actually asked him this question. And he wrote a letter, a very interesting letter, about someone who, so this is interesting, just want to give you an interesting perspective here. Someone that was a yeshiva student who had suffered from OCD, and because of that, would repeat the Shema over and over and over again. Why? Because it is written in the code of Jewish law that during davening, when you daven, you're supposed to have focus. You're supposed to have kavanah. But if you don't, the davening is still kosher. But there's certain parts of davening where kavanah is critical. For example, one of them is the sentence of Shema. So when you say Shema, you're really supposed to think about the translation of the words. And you're supposed to have that focus. That's one of the reasons we cover our eyes, to remove distractions and so on. This person kept on repeating the words, kept on repeating the Shema, until some of the teachers, the mentors, the family didn't know what to do. So they came to the stipler, they came to this rabbi for a halachic ruling, and he said a very, very interesting thing, which in later years was very much validated by professional therapists in this whole treatment of OCD. And he said, "You need to tell the person that he only has to say the Shema once. And once he said the Shema once, it is considered, it is sufficient, and he has to, when he reads the words, reading the words is enough, and he has to just keep going." And then he went on to say, he said, "It is forbidden to give him reasons or explanations." Things like, "It's enough because probably you had some level of kavanah, some level of focus, so it's enough that you can..." No. As soon as you say that, he will doubt that. He will say, "No, I don't think I did. Or I don't think I had any concentration." So he said something which therapists actually highlight later, and I've heard this from quite people who are experts in the field. That this is an incredible concept, that it's definitive. You say it once and that's it. You don't have to say it anymore. There's a great halakhic authority that lives today in Israel who's quite involved in mental illness issues. His name is Rav Osher Weiss. And he wrote an interesting response that sometimes you can tell a person who's obsessive and is expressing himself in prayer that he's absolved from the mitzvah of prayer altogether. And I'm not going to go into all the reasoning now, but this is what he says, which is quite amazing. Rav Nachman of Breslev, who lived a few hundred years ago, already addresses the issue of obsessiveness. And he talks about people who are over-obsessed with cleaning for Pesach, or people over-obsess themselves with cleaning themselves before prayer. And he ridicules it. He says it's absolutely not necessary, and it's not good, and it's not part of religious and divine service. And it's just interesting to see that already 200 years ago he was dealing with this at that time. That's one of the roles that rabbis play, is to assist the therapist in I got a call from a parent who asked me permission if the therapist could talk to me, and the therapist asked me for some help, and I'm not a therapist, but the help was to give the person in question, was a young man who was really suffering from OCD, some definitive halachic rulings of what they could say or what they could do and what they shouldn't do, that would be a authoritative sort of ruling, and that would assist the therapist in the treatment of the position. So there's a great partnership there. But once again, and I've said this 15 times already, it should never be a substitute for professional therapy. The other role that the rabbi plays, again, part of the therapy for OCD is managing the thinking, and in managing the thinking, often again, spiritual guidance, spiritual knowledgeable friends or spiritual mentor can certainly be a support in concepts which help manage the thinking of the person. So that's another very common area of mental illness. I want to go just mention another one, which I think unfortunately is so common today on many, many different levels, and that's the illness of addiction. Now, I put it in the group of mental illness because exactly what it is. Anything where a person loses control becomes an illness, right? Now, once again, not everything is an addiction, right? Those of us who like chocolate and cannot find it hard to hold back in having a second helping of ice cream, that doesn't mean we're addicted. We just need a good talking to, and we need to... No, I mean, it's not as simple as that. Obviously, we need to really study. We need to reflect. Their spiritual guidance is absolutely necessary. It doesn't even always help, but you need to really, you know, do it more and learn what the sources tell us and understand why we eat and get some spiritual focus and work on ourselves. We have to grow as human beings. We don't need spiritual intervention, but we don't need medical intervention. However, that is all true. But again, when something happens, so for example, if someone wastes too much time, you know, someone says, you know, I really got to control my iPhone use. I shouldn't spend so much time each night looking at the latest news, or following American politics or following Israeli politics, whatever the case is, I need to limit. That's not an addiction necessarily, it's just that, you know, we're a bit lazy or we're prone to wasting time, so we can work on ourselves or we can engage in personal growth and self-control, which is so important. But when it gets to a point where we do something that we just cannot control, no matter what happens, whether it's alcohol, whether it's substance abuse, whether it's internet abuse, whether it's pornography addiction, which unfortunately is quite common today, whatever it is becomes an addiction, and an addiction is something that absolutely needs intervention. There are great programs that deal with addiction, the 12-step program, therapy, combination of things, but it is so important that if you know someone who is suffering from addiction, to encourage them to seek professional assistance. Once again, absolutely, there's a tremendous role there for a partnership between spiritual support and medical intervention, but it does also need medical intervention, proper therapy. It can be gambling, it can be alcoholism, and so on and so forth. Very interesting, we go back to the sources again, although addiction is much more understood today, but nevertheless, it is spoken about in very early sources in the late 1500s. The Maharshal, Reb Shlomo Luria, great halachic authority, describes a case where there was a husband that was addicted to gambling and alcohol, and obviously affecting his marriage in a very, very strong way. And he ruled that the person is halachically obligated to seek intervention, to seek help, to the point that if he refused to do it and he resisted the help, the woman would have a very strong case and a grounds for divorce. Even earlier than that, we find a sort of also a thing which is also a sickness often, is the concept of domestic abuse. When I say it's a sickness, I'm not taking away the responsibility at all from the perpetrator. But nevertheless, sometimes it is something that a person has twisted thinking and is a very aggressive, angry person and so on and so forth. And that can lead to violence and aggressiveness. and it's unacceptable. Rav Shlomo ben Aderes, the Rashba in the 1200s, addressed this and also again said the person needs to seek help, because if not, again, that's a grounds for separation, and the woman could certainly take him to court and demand a divorce. Now, I know we're running out of time, but I just want to give me 1 second. Maybe I'll. Actually, no, I don't want to actually deal with it. Maybe I'll leave this for next week, but because we can fit into next week easy, I think. But I did want to look at some of the response and some of the letters, fascinating concepts that is written in some of the letters of the great Talachic authorities, and particularly one area of letters that is from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but I'll leave it for next week because we are running out of time. So I guess what I wanted to accomplish tonight is this. First of all, just raise awareness of some of the more common areas of mental stress or mental illness. The purpose of raising awareness is to understand that what it looks like, not to be judgmental, but more going back to what I said last week about the support that we have to give and the encouragement we have to give to people who are going through this. Because as I said last week, the responsibility to seek help and to protect our own health, physically or mentally or emotionally. Physically, we have to do it ourselves. We have the moral responsibility. Emotionally and mentally, we're not always able, and therefore it becomes a collective responsibility. So when we know some of the symptoms, when we know some of the ways we can support, we need to be able to raise awareness of what these things look like so we can recognize it and really either reach out to the person themselves, or sometimes sometimes it could be a friend reaching out to a parent, for example, of a friend. So, you notice in your friend something really bad, you reach out to a relative, you reach out to a loved one, something's going on with this person, they're losing interest in their normal interests of pleasure, they seem to be going through an anxious period. The more you become aware, the more you start to realize and be aware of some of the things that are happening. Just to finish off one little point, interesting that in modern halachic literature, as I mentioned, it's becoming more and more common. There are now people writing responsa on halachic issues to do with mental illness. I mean, things even as simple as depression and Yom Kippur and fasting, which often we rule that a person with depression should not fast, because often they absolutely need to keep their rhythm of their food pattern or the medication that they must take, because if they don't take it, they have a relapse, and the person can be at real risk, can be a danger of life even, and that cannot be tampered with. Or for example, in a case, I think a couple of years ago, where I was consulted, and what I obviously did right away is I contacted some medical professionals, but often people with another area of mental illness, unfortunately, which is not so uncommon either, is food disorders. And he was a person who was, thank God, making very big progress and really making good progress, but it's always at risk of a relapse. And part of the progress when it comes to food disorders is the pattern and the routine of eating, the healthy routine of eating. And in consultation with a medical professional, we ruled that no, as important as Yom Kippur is, it's really important to keep that routine of eating, and therefore that person shouldn't fast. So these things I mention this not only because they're interesting, but also because, in Jewish observance, for example, things like Yom Kippur are really important. And if someone's unwell, they should really, make sure that they actually are permitted to eat on Yom Kippur. But at the same time, the mitzvah of protecting one's health is also so important. I'll just finish with a story of Reb Chaim Briska, I think it was, a great halachic authority who lived in Brisk before the war. And one time there was a plague in the city, and it was the doctors had ruled that people really need to eat. And Reb Chaim Briska was known to be very strict, to be very stringent in all the laws of Torah, like extra strict. He was a very strict authority. And it came Yom Kippur, and in the middle of Shacharit, he went up on the bimah, and he gave a clap on the bimah, and he said, everyone must eat. And to demonstrate the point, he took out some cake, he poured some wine, he made kiddush, and he ate. And someone asked him afterwards, he said, how come you were so lenient with Yom Kippur? After all, you're known to be a person that is strict, a stringent person. So he said, I was not being lenient with Yom Kippur. I was being strict with the mitzvah of protecting the health. Right? As I said, protecting one's health is a mitzvah. And that goes, therefore, together with protecting our mental health. It's an important mitzvah, and sometimes we need to be very strict about it and very careful about it. And the reason that I mentioned before about how this is now addressed so often in halachic literature is because I think that's amazing, because what's happening is that in the Jewish world, apart from this, from the medical and scientific world, but thankfully in the Jewish world, we are keeping up with that awareness. And more that awareness is creeping into our to Jewish literature, halachic literature, and religious literature, where you see that awareness creeping into halachic questions which weren't perhaps asked a generation or two generations ago. There are some sources, as I mentioned, but not as much as it is today. But the awareness must come together by incorporating that into the religious discussion. It's got to go together. So the fact that there's more awareness today of mental illness is fantastic, but that awareness then must extend, and thank God, thankfully it is extending, and spilling over to religious discussion, spiritual discussion, halachic discussion, and all the other areas of Jewish experience. So once again, especially the time that we're going through now, really important to be on the lookout, really important to understand the partnership and the combination between the spiritual support, meaningful support, purposeful support, and medical support intervention, and hopefully we can always increase that awareness and increase our mitzvah of helping ourselves, protecting our own health, and helping the health of others. Next week, we're going to have a look at we're going to delve into some of these concepts a little bit further, but I also want to deal with a very, very sensitive but very critical topic of the Jewish view on suicide and the support and prevention and so on and so forth. So I thank you once again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for the third installment. Thank you, Rabbi Friedman, once again.